How does the Beatles' first appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show, as well as the Rolling Stones' first U.S. performance at the Swing Auditorium in Southern California, relate to the Walkman, the iPod, and music as we know it today? Find out about all this and more on Full Circle Analog, the podcast hosted by Brad Blue, the man who, like many, was there through it all. The first and second British invasion, Bruce Springsteen, Elton John, and so, so many more. As well as sometimes me, Alec Blue, his son and fellow lover of music, who comes on to provide a more modern perspective as well as learn about the past.
Today's podcast on Full Circle Analog, we're going to look back at a couple things that came to be, and I'm talking today about the Christmas specials that came on. Now, there was all kinds of Christmas specials, but we're not going to talk about the Andy Williams and the Perry Como's and the Frank Sinatra's and the crooners and those type of shows. And those evolved through the 60s and the 70s. But today we're talking about what I call the claymation Christmas animated shows. It started in the mid-60s, and then a huge cluster of them appeared in the late 60s. I call most of them claymation, but that's not really what they're called. They're called stop-motion animation. And there were several of them that were produced by the same company that was known as Rankin and Bass, and those are the last names of the two individuals who formed the company. Arthur Rankin Jr. and Jules Bass were the names. And they were in TV. TV, as you have to realize, was in its beyond its infancy, and it's beyond its early days of burlesque actors and vaudeville actors making the jump from live stage to live television. We're going to look at my favorites. These are favorites that I have watched not every year, but pretty much every year. They came on once a year, of course. And then when the advent of VHS tape, they were sold in video stores. And every Christmas I got one during the video era. So I was able to watch them whenever I wanted. A lot of these have played every year for decades. And the first one we're going to look at, and it was the first one in a series of claymation, stop-motion animated cartoons that we'll look at as Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer was produced in 1964, released 64, 65. I'm a little confused doing research on that. With the story based on how Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer came to be, with an interesting cast of characters from my favorite, Yukon Cornelius, to the dentist, to Rudolph himself, Santa, all the reindeer, and Burl Ives as the snowman. Now, Burl Ives was a pop singer with his very unique voice, and the show spawned a hit record called Silver and Gold. And then there's the Misfit song, which later was known as Fame and Fortune, Fame and Fortune, as the dentist Rudolph Yukon Cornelius all venture out for fame and fortune as they feel they are misfits. One of my favorite scenes from that is when they encounter the island of misfit toys. As with a lot of cartoons, there's a lot of adult themes intermingled in with childhood fantasy, you know, action hero type stuff, whatever. But the things that stick out to me is, the danger, the abominable snowman, elf that doesn't want to be an elf, he wants to be a dentist, Rudolph being outcast, even by his own father, for having a nose that glowed. This was based on a story that was actually written in 1939. You know, if you wonder, where did Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer concept come from? It came from a story that was written in 1939. And from there, it was adapted to make this claymation movie. So it was written by a Robert L. May, 1939 story, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and that inspired the 1949 song written by May's brother-in-law. So it was kind of all in the family, this concept of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, written by Robert May and his brother-in-law, Johnny Marks, wrote the song to go with it, which we have known and sung since we were little kids. So, to put this into a animated children's movie, adding the clout of a Burl Ives voice, he did the voiceover, did the singing. If you listen to some of the oldies radio stations today in Southern California, KBIG 103.5 has been playing Christmas music since, I think they've used to wait until Thanksgiving Day and played it through Christmas Day. Now they start earlier. You'll hear Burl Ives, Silver and Gold. It premiered December 6th, 1964, and played usually the first week of December every year after that until 1972, where it moved to CBS and played for several more years. This was the first of many that were produced by Rankin and Bass, and just like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer was based not only on a story, but on a song, the following several claymation Rankin Bass productions were all based on Christmas songs as well. That's one theme that connects these together. But each of them was an hour long, had songs you could sing along with, and characters, bad guys, good triumphs over evil, trying to explain the Christmas story through the song that inspired it. The next one that came out, now this was 1964, so there was quite a gap between 64 and the next one, by Rankin and Bass, which was The Little Drummer Boy. It came out in Christmas at 1968, and once again it had a star-studded lineup. This time the actress Greer Garson, who had this wonderful kind of bourbon-like baritone voice as the narrator, and Jose Ferrer, the actor, voiced the lead voice of Ben Haramed. Actually a no good businessman who encounters the little drummer boy who's become orphaned as his parents. It's pretty savage, actually. He has to flee as his house is burned down, and I believe his parents perished in it. And he is next found in this traveling caravan, if you will. And, of course, they make it to Jerusalem at the birth of Jesus, and it tells the story of how this little boy came to the manger and gave the only gift he had, and that was the gift of playing his music, his drum. I mean, to this day, the Little Drummer Boy is one of my favorite songs. It's just something spiritual about it. I'm not going into the history of the song, but that was the song that was, of course, a hit song that was part of this claymation. So we have a little drummer boy who's orphaned, joins a caravan. It's the time of the census, the time of Passover. They have to go to Jerusalem, and the little drummer boy plays for the baby Jesus. This claymation slow motion animated capture was released Christmas time 1968. The thing that's singular about this, as I've just been talking about, is it's based on, of course, a famous Christmas song, but its theme is specifically about the story from Luke 2 about the baby Jesus in the manger, when the little drummer boy plays his drum for the baby Jesus, and the baby Jesus smiles. In just a bit, we're going to look at another animation, Christmas animation, that was not produced by Rankin and Bass, but had a scene at the time added in it that the producers didn't want to have in it, and the producer was adamant that it'd be in it, and that was the reading from Luke chapter 2. But I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. The thing that was so striking about the Little Drummer Boy is its theme was specific to the New Testament narrative of Jesus' birth in Bethlehem. Now begins a huge flurry of activity for Rankin Bass. There was a 4-year gap between Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. I always get confused with that because I love Dean Martin, and I love Dean Martin Christmas songs, and he has a hysterical song called Rudy the Red-Nosed Reindeer. So I'm always calling Rudolph Rudy. But from 1964 to 1968, we had a gap. The Little Drummer Boy came out in Christmas of 1968, and over the next each Christmas had a brand new animated movie to enjoy. It was once again based on a song, and the song this time was Frosty the Snowman. Totally fictitious, made-up story to add to the Christmas lore. And this one, once again, had the same format, a format of famous actors or singers or both doing the narration and doing voiceover for the main characters. And this one, Frosty the Snowman, the narrator is Jimmy Durante. He's actually in the animation with his patented big nose, which he joked about himself. He's the narrator. He walks through the scenes of the show. And the comedian, this is a really interesting casting pick. I'd like to know how Jackie Vernon, I saw Jackie Vernon on the Ed Sullivan Show. And he had his shtick with his stand-up comedy was pretending we were watching his slideshow of various vacations, like the original slideshows we used to watch on 35 millimeter slides. With disastrous results. This is my brother falling off the cliff. This is my, you know, whatever. He had a very unique style and delivery, and his whole shtick was stand-up, and you had to imagine that there was a projector and a screen behind him, and he was narrating what his family home movies was all about. So Jackie Vernon is playing the lead of Frosty the Snowman. And of course, this story starts with, it's Christmas time and an elementary school class. The teacher has invited a magician into the class, kind of a bumbling magician type. And he tells the kids that he has a magic top hat. And of course, he uses it to pull a rabbit out of a hat, literally. But in this case, it is a magic hat. And as this bumbling magician stumbles through all his tricks, he discovers that it in fact is a magic hat. The rabbit notices it is too, and puts it on his head, and he can't see because he's just a little rabbit, and he bounds out of the classroom, out into the snow, where the kids have been making a snowman because there's a snowstorm during class, and they're on recess. And the snowman, when they put this magic hat on his head, comes to life, of course. The story of Frosty the Snowman. And they sing that song in the show. And the foil now becomes the magician wants his hat back because it's magic. He can make lots of money with a magic hat doing tricks that really work. And he will be in... as he sees riches ahead of him, all he has to do is regain possession of the magic hat. And the story takes off from there. Even though it's snowing, the children know that Frosty can't stay with them forever because eventually the snow will melt and so will Frosty. So they try to figure out a way to help Frosty to the North Pole, because they figure that will be the coldest place, and it's near Christmas, so Santa will be involved, and it'll all end happily ever after. So the magician is chasing the children as they board a train to the North Pole, right? And two things the children, of course, this is a TV show and it's a cartoon, but the children don't think twice about having to get home to their families or parents. And two, they're on a train going to the North Pole, and one of the children, the little girl, starts to freeze to death. So the story proceeds from there as Frosty is trying to figure out a way to save himself, but more importantly, being the selfless snowman that he is, tries to find safety for the little girl, and in doing so, Frosty finds himself in a very precarious position in a greenhouse that's growing poinsettias for Christmas. And of course, Frosty melts. But Santa comes to the rescue. Frosty is restored, and the magician gets in big trouble with Santa and is told to go home and write a gazillion times that he will never do that again, and he's sorry for what he did to Frosty. That came out in Christmas of 1969. So this is the second of a trio of claymation, stop-motion, animated Rankin Bass productions that came out in successive Christmases. We went from 64 with Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, The Little Drummer Boy in 1968, Frosty the Snowman came out in 1969, and in 1970, a little more interesting one comes out. This one attempts to explain how Santa Claus came into being in the first place. It's called Santa Claus is Coming to Town, based once again on the song of the same title. And once again, it has famous actors or performers in the lead roles. There's always a narrator. And just like Jimmy Durante was in the animation of Frosty, as well as narrating his own animated character himself, this time it's the famous actor, dancer extraordinaire Fred Astaire. And playing Santa Claus is Mickey Rooney. Fred Astaire is the narrator. He's actually the mailman in this. Interesting. Now we're moving into the 70s, and it draws heavily on stereotypes of the hippie era, as it goes from Santa's birth all the way to him being grown up, and how tries to explain how he's able to do all the things that he's able to do, like get down the chimney at night, how do the reindeer fly, where did he get his name, Santa Claus. It explains all of these wonderful things. The nemesis in this one is a character created known as the Winter Warlock. The Winter Warlock does not like Christmas. He's a grouch and anything related to. His main thing is he protects these woods that he lives in, and he doesn't want anybody in there. The voice of the Winter Warlock is played by Keenan Wynn, and he is a famous character actor. He was a child actor and character actor, and he plays the Winter Warlock, and his character is magnificent. And the crazy character in this one, not a famous actor that I'm aware of it anyway, played the Burgermeister Meisterburger. The Burgermeister Meisterburger is the mayor of the town, and the Burgermeister Meisterburger hates children, and he outlaws toys. Preposterous, I know, but you have to run with this idea, as what he's trying to do is capture Santa Claus and arrest him because he brings happiness and he sneaks into people's houses, which is illegal, right? It's very hippie oriented. There's a song in it that's so dated that I can hardly watch the scene anymore, where the love interest of Santa, the woman who becomes Mrs. Claus, sings this song of love about life and her relationship with psychedelic flowers and tie-dyed this and that. And this came out in 1970. Santa Claus is Coming to Town. It's another one-hour show, the same Rankin-Bass production, with the same kind of format as the previous Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, The Little Drummer Boy, Frosty the Snowman, and Santa Claus is Coming to Town. Now, Rankin-Bass Productions produced many other very similar type shows, but they got into that trap, I think, of making sequels. And in my experience, whether it was something from back then or even something even closer to the present, whenever they make a sequel of anything, it's just never as good as the original. And there were many different titles, and many different. And then, of course, they got away from stop-motion animated or claymation and got into straight animation. Because if you look up or Google stop-motion animation and how to do it, it's laborious. You have to film these clay-made type creatures, kind of like a stick drawing you do on the bottom of a notepad, and then you'd, like a deck of cards, go through all of them very quickly, and it gives the impression that the stick figure is actually moving. And so it requires several dozens, if not hundreds, of drawings. But in this case, the characters are there with a camera, and even with today's technology, trying to recreate that is very laborious. I was looking it up on Googling it, and it was quite fascinating, but very time-consuming to realize that they pumped out one of these a year. 1968, 1969, and 1970 is actually quite amazing, considering they had the audio production to worry about, especially the songs, the performers, integrating that into the lip-syncing and in with the characters in the animation, all the other technical aspects of it. And this was 1968, 1969, and 1970. Amazing. So as the 60s were ending, you've heard me talk endlessly in previous podcasts about how music was shifting in the late 60s. The Beatles were towards the end of their amazing run, and these shows were right there. I mean, 68, 69, and 70, you know, while Woodstock is going on, while the Beatles are breaking up, these shows start coming out every Christmas, endearing the public to them. And so we had this running all at the same time. Last one we're going to look at is probably the most amazing one of all. It's not in the Rankin-Bass file, but it stands in its own right, because who of us does not love the Peanuts cartoon strip, Charlie Brown, Linus, Lucy, Woodstock, and all those characters? Peanuts started way before this particular show we are going to talk about. But the amazing thing about It's Christmas, Charlie Brown, is that the whole thing was put together in 6 months. Now, this was an animation show. Now, by the early 60s, Charles Schulz's comic strip, Peanuts, was a huge draw, big hit. It was syndicated in newspapers. It was even animated already in commercial spots for the Ford Motor Company. Now, Lee Mendelson, who was a television producer at the time, was enamored, as so many of us were, of this unique cartoon strip, and thought he had an idea to bring it to, wasn't quite sure at the time, but wanted to bring it to a special, a documentary or something like that. And he called Charles Schulz, and Schulz invited him to his home in Sebastopol. Charles Schulz was a native of Minnesota, but moved out west as a married man, adult, and lived in Northern California for the rest of his life. He was a World War II veteran, but that's it on his personal life for purposes of this podcast. He invited Lee Mendelson out to his place. They discussed different ideas, and Schulz was intrigued. He was a very private guy, very opinionated, and guarded his creation very closely, as you can imagine. But he recognized Mendelson during their conversation as the one who produced a biography, a documentary on Willie Mays, the San Francisco Giant baseball player. And Charles Schulz unbeknownst to Melendez, was a huge baseball fan. So they immediately had a bond. And one thing led to another, and the idea came out to do an animated Christmas. From there, that's where that 6 months from the point of deciding and signing the contracts on that, it took, they had a deadline of 6 months before Christmas to get it on TV for Christmas that year. Otherwise, you know, they would have finished it and it would have sat probably for 8 or 10 months. Momentum would have, you know, probably died and it might never have aired. That's part of the backstory. And of course, we know that, you know, Melendez recommended an animator who was already gaining fame to come on board. That was Melendez, Bill Melendez. And he came on as the animator. And Charles Schulz, who, you know, he had a few passions. He was a very religious man. He was actually Lutheran. Charles Schulz's other passion was music, specifically jazz. And in their circle, Melendez's circle of acquaintances and contacts, he knew of Vince Guaraldi, who had already written some interesting modern jazz pieces. And so they tied him into the production, all because Charles Schulz, you know, his faith, which is in his characters, everyone in Peanuts is someone in Charles Schulz's life. He likened himself to Charlie Brown. Like Linus's great line in It's Christmas, Charlie Brown, is of Arl, he tells Charlie, of all the Charlie Browns in the world, you're the Charlie Browniest. That was Charles Schulz. He lived his and shared his family with us through his cartoon. So we have the religious angle and we have the jazz angle. And thus enters, just like with the Rankin-Bass productions based on a Christmas song, well, in this case, it created an iconic song within a Christmas animation production. The Ballad of Linus and Lucy was born and written for It's Christmas, Charlie Brown. And that song, I think, is probably one of the most well-known songs on the planet. Everybody knows that rhythm. Gets your toes tapping and your fingers snapping. It just has that quality to it. Amazing piano part to it and the jazz and all that. And they wrote quickly the soundtrack to it, the script. Matter of fact, that Christmas Time is Near, the opening song that the children sing at the beginning, Bill Melendez wrote on an back of an envelope in 15 minutes before they went in to do it. I mean, that's how this thing came to be. Things just happen. And they just, you know, ran with it. And the biggest controversy with It's Christmas, Charlie Brown, was the birth of Jesus story be in the show. Of course, we know the background. I'm sure you've seen it. But it starts off where Charlie Brown is depressed. He's talking to his friend Linus. And Linus is trying to cheer him up. And Charlie just doesn't get Christmas. And of course, he runs into, you know, various, you know, from his sister to Lucy. That's one of my favorite parts of the whole thing. It's such an interesting show because the children talk like adults. And that's another thing about the film strip is the grown-ups, the parents, the guardians are never in it. They're always off camera or implied, but not even that. It's a story about kids. But they're kids in an adult world that actually think and talk like adults. I mean, because they one of the things that Charles Schulz developed was Lucy being a psychiatrist and having a booth set up in the neighborhood so that the kids can come and tell her their problems for 5 cents. Love it. The doctor, she had this sign that said, "The doctor is real in," another reference to the cool, hip, late 60s, early 70s. But so Lucy counsels Charlie Brown in this, and Charlie Brown's own sister just before that Charlie's going to go over and talk to Linus, like, oh, it's Christmas again. Linus, what are we going to do? I don't know why, but Christmas just doesn't do it for me. And on the way out the door, Charlie Brown's sister says, would you help me write my letter to Santa? And, of course, being the good older brother, he says yes. And his Sally, I think, is her name. And she starts listing all these things she wants. And then she realizes even herself that the list is so long, she tells Charlie to write in the letter to Santa, well, if you want, just send cash. Tens and twenties will be fine. And Charlie Brown just loses it and walks out the door. And Sally announces, well, I only want my fair share. I only want what's coming to me. You know, so there's this sarcasm about Christmas that runs throughout this whole thing. And it's so Charles Schulz. It's so Peanuts. Like Lucy wanting Charlie Brown to kick the football at the last second, she pulls the football away. You know, that kind of thing. So we run through all these negative things about Christmas. And then out of the blue, Lucy, the neighborhood girl, tells Charlie Brown they need a director for the Christmas play. And of course, Charlie just lights up. Me direct a Christmas play? And he gets totally into it. He accepts the role and he gets totally into it. And of course, mayhem ensues and all the, or not mayhem so much, but all the different personalities. Charlie Brown thinks that they need a Christmas tree for the Christmas play because the set just needs something extra. And of course, they get on Charlie, you better pick the right tree. And there's a really bizarre concept. When Charlie and Linus go to the Christmas tree lot, like they got money to buy a Christmas tree. But this is in mid-1960s. All the trees on the lot are made of aluminum. And that's the so-called hip thing that holiday season. You've got to have an aluminum Christmas tree. And there's only one real tree on the lot. And, of course, that's the one Charlie Brown picks out. And all the members of the cast, all the characters from Peanuts that we know and love, don't like it. And Charlie gets all upset and in desperation says, Linus, what is Christmas all about? And Linus, in one of the most brilliant moments in an animated cartoon, says, I'll tell you what Christmas is all about, Charlie Brown. Linus then takes center stage, the spotlights dim, and he recites from memory Luke from the New Testament of the Bible, Luke chapter 2, verses 8 through 14. The manger story, the birth of Jesus, the announcement. Then he looks off stage. That's what Christmas is all about, Charlie Brown. The networks were afraid to put that in, especially those that were advertisers. But it was insistent that they leave that in. And as it turns out, that is one of the most endearing parts of that entire show. This show was only a half an hour long. This was not a full hour like the Rankin-Bass productions, but A Charlie Brown Christmas came out the first week of December 1965, produced by Lee Mendelson, directed by Bill Melendez. with the famous soundtrack from the Vince Guaraldi Trio, including the Ballad of Linus and Lucy, and all those great instrumental tracks that weave into that half-hour narrative. For the children that were picked, which is a story unto itself, when the children who were picked to do the voices of Charlie Brown, Linus, Lucy, etc., they were recording in a recording studio, obviously, and next door, of all things, the Jefferson Airplane was recording an album. And when they caught wind of what was going on, they became fans themselves and got all the children's autographs, who were the stars of the show. And the children who did the voiceovers for Charlie, etc., in their respective schools were just elevated to saints. I'm sure there was some jealousy, but it's in Wikipedia, it says that they were treated like celebrities at their respective schools. There was a choir from San Rafael, which is not, I don't know how far it is from Sebastopol, that was used to do the opening. Christmas time is near. And which I mentioned a few minutes ago was written in 15 minutes on an envelope by the producer walking in that day when he forgot that the lyrics hadn't been written. That's the whole thing about this thing. That took from the time the contracts were signed, like I said, it took 6 months from start to finish for Vince Guaraldi to write all the music and perform it, write the script, animate it, and actually in 1960, mid-60s technology, actually do the work to get it TV ready was all done in 6 months. It was broadcast originally on CBS December 9th, 1965 at 7:30 Eastern Time, preempting the Munsters, and was viewed by 45% of those people watching television that night. It's been on every year since and is considered, just like the Rankin-Bass, especially the Rankin-Bass Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. I don't think Frosty, especially the Little Drummer Boy and Santa Claus is Coming to Town, are as popular. But I would say, in my book, that Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and A Charlie Brown Christmas are the top, at the top of the pile, the top of the, for quality, storyline, songs. You know, we looked at it from Burl Ives to Jimmy Durante to Fred Astaire, Keenan Wynn. I mean, the list of stars and actors and celebrities that did these, you know, added that extra special touch. Over the years, I remember after I got the VHS tapes, was so thrilled that I had them and I could watch them anytime during the holidays, during the VCR era. Then, of course, they came out on DVD when DVDs replaced VHS. Because I have the ability to do so, it's what I do. Put all of my original VHS recordings of these shows onto DVD. I look forward. It's hard to get them all in every year, but this core group is the ones that I truly cherish. As I alluded to a few minutes ago, even back then, they tried to do sequels of the originals, and they just didn't make it. They just didn't have it. These original shows, I think there's just something about the creative juices that flow and not knowing where it's going to end up and letting the muse guide you. The first of anything is always the best. They never tried to make a sequel of A Charlie Brown Christmas. That's just one of a kind. And it turned out to be, you know, the Charlie Brown Christmas, they were concerned about how it would be viewed. I just mentioned the statistics that almost half of the TV viewing audience that night in December 9th watched the show And the reviews were overwhelmingly wonderful, positive, loved it. Many loved the biblical reading in it, which I had mentioned is one of my favorite parts. It's just, if you watch it, though, it's unusual. And I know my wife has said that she doesn't like it as much because it's just kind of a downer. But I see through that, through the Charles Schulz humor, that it's really a positive story about what Christmas is all about. So we hope that you enjoyed this extra length podcast about the birth of the Christmas animation shows that came on in the 1960s. It started in the mid-60s and culminated around 1970, that where stop-motion animation was used, which is very difficult to film. They really were a labor of love and just have added to our holiday enjoyment year after year after year, generation after generation after generation, and you know, lo and behold, they're still with us all these decades later. So to all of you out there, hope you have a very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, even in the midst of these challenging times. We're here in Southern California, in most cities, I think we're going to be hunkered down and just trying to stay healthy and safe. Goodbye, everybody.